So the title given for the lecture was Bhagavad Gita and Living Today, in our lives today. Bhagavad Gita in our lives today. Well, looks like Bhagavad Gita has become part of your life today. We'll distribute copies afterwards. Bhagavad Gita. Is this any sound coming?
Yeah.
Bhagavad Gita is known as a religious book, although originally it's not a book, it's a conversation, later recorded as a book. It's widely known to be the most important among the many religious books of the Hindus, and therefore pious Hindus like to keep a copy in their homes, and some of the more pious like to recite verses or even chapters from it daily, or to sometimes attend lectures on Bhagavad Gita, as you are doing now. So if we're to say what is the place of Bhagavad Gita in our lives, we could say that, well, it's part of our religious life. We have our working life and our family life, and we may have hobbies, entertainment, and we also have our religious life. So different people at different levels of commitment have religious life. Many families, even today in India, have the habit of visiting a temple once a week, usually for a few minutes. But it doesn't often go much beyond that. However, Bhagavad Gita is not meant to be put in some box, our religious box that we open up from time to time. Bhagavad Gita, as you know, was spoken by Bhagavan Krishna to Arjuna just before the fighting was about to commence at Kurukshetra, the great battle of Kurukshetra 5,000 years ago. Now, it wasn't that Arjuna said to Krishna that, well, there's little time before the fighting, let's have a little religious talk. That's not how Bhagavad Gita came about. It wasn't even that Arjuna asked for any religious discussion, per se. But rather, Arjuna felt himself overwhelmed by a great dilemma, felt himself in a very problematic situation. Now, this is how Bhagavad Gita relates in our lives today. Because we're all in problematic situations, one after the other. In fact, life, from one perspective at least, could be seen as one problem after another and how to overcome them. All the time there are different problems. Many of you are software engineers, is it? Or writing programs, all kinds of things like that. So your job is practically finding solutions.
Yeah.
You run into problem after problem after problem, and it's your job to somehow or other work it out. And if you can do it in an innovative manner, well, that's what you're there for, and then you're considered good at your job. So you don't just look for the ordinary solution or the stereotype solution, but you try to find something novel. And we can say that the whole progress of modern science is problem solving. That Copernicus found a problem with the biblical dogma that the sun goes around the earth. So he had another theory. And all the boundaries of science are being pushed further and further by examining phenomena, applying hypotheses to them, experimenting, making general theories, and then what happens is then when people go deeper, they find the theories don't fit anymore, and then we have a problem. And then someone else comes up with something else, and this is how it goes on. The progress of science. So life is full of problems. This kind of problem is these are challenging intellectual problems. But apart from that, we have other problems which don't stimulate us so much, rather they drag us down. We have personal problems, financial problems, existential problems. Maybe your children who are brought up in America, they may find they have the existential problem of having one culture at home and another one outside. So life is full of problems, and the endeavor to meet them. And when we overcome a difficult situation, it makes us feel good. There are many books available in the market, testimonies of how people, they had so many health problems, and they went to this doctor and that doctor and nothing worked, and then they finally find the solution, bingo, whatever it may be. It's different for different people. Raw food, homeopathy, acupuncture, Ayurveda, meditation. So people, this is the solution to your health problems. So life is a series of problems and how to overcome it. And many, many books are also published at the present time on how to overcome obstacles in our personal lives, management, how to deal with people in the workplace, how to motivate people to work better, how to smooth out the inevitable personal problems that arise in the workplace. These are all tasks for managers, and therefore we have the one minute manager and 59 second employee and all this, how to outsmart each other, problems and how to overcome them. Arjuna's problem, that was an existential problem at the very deepest level. Arjuna's problem wasn't one that could be solved by taking vitamin E tablets. It wasn't one that could be solved even just by going to the temple and saying a few prayers. Arjuna was about to fight a battle, which that wasn't a problem for him. It would be a problem for any one of us if we were asked to pick up a gun and catch a helicopter to Baghdad and get dropped in the anti-American area. I mean, that's 99% of the city. That would be a problem for us if we had to fight a battle. It wasn't a problem. That in itself wasn't a problem for Arjuna, because he was trained, kshatriya. Nowadays in India, kshatriya means someone who thinks they have a license to eat meat, but it actually means a lot more than that. Kshatriya means one who is trained to protect others, who is ready to kill persons who act so wrongly that they disrupt human society. So it's a very responsible task, that one must be trained in dharma to know that one is doing the right thing. What is a correct battle to fight? What is not? The Vedic Kshatriyas were fierce people, noble, but righteous, dharmic also. So Arjuna was exemplary in his character. He had never committed any sin in his whole life. In Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna addresses Arjuna as Anagha, one who never committed any sin, even though he killed many people. In the modern age, killing under any circumstances is considered bad, but according to Vedic Dharma, that is required. If, for instance, a person kills another meaninglessly or to steal their money, then according to Vedic Dharma, that person should be killed, and there's no sin in doing so. Rather, if that person is not killed, he will have to suffer worse karma in future lives. Therefore, the kshatriya actually helps that person by taking away their sins by executing them in this life. Now, this is not to ratify or promote the kind of raw justice that we see carried out in some Islamic countries, just like public stoning to death for even apparently minor crimes. But there is in Vedic Dharma the prescription for capital punishment and for fighting if required. Just like if Pakistan were to launch a full-scale attack on India, then it would be foolish to say ahimsa and let them come in and just destroy everything and loot everything. So that's a practical example. I think you'd all agree with that, isn't it?
Yep.
That it's then the Indian army is there. It's not just for making a parade on Republic Day. They have a function to perform, and that should be, they should perform it when required. So kshatriyas are required, and Arjuna was a most righteous kshatriya, and the battle was about to begin, and the battle was justified because Duryodhana and company had taken away the kingdom of Yudhishthira, the rightful kingdom, by cheating. And Yudhishthira, he wasn't greedy, but to execute his kshatriya dharma, he required to have a kingdom. So a proposal was given that actually the whole kingdom should be for Yudhishthira, but he said, give me half. No. Then at least give something. No. Give us, we have five brothers, give us five villages. No, we will not give you as even that much land and a pin can be pushed into. Then there had to be a fight. It was inevitable. But Arjuna's dilemma was that by force of circumstance, and fate is very tricky. We can never understand what will happen. The way that life goes, we can never predict what strange situations we may find ourselves in. So Arjuna was particularly concerned that on the opposite party were his gurus, particularly Bhishma and Drona, who had, Drona was the Astroguru of the Pandavas. He taught them how to fight, and Arjuna was his dearest disciple. And now he was standing opposite, saying, this is the opposite party, these are the people I have to fight with to kill. And Bhishma had protected, the Pitamaha had protected the Pandavas throughout their lives. He was their great well-wisher. So Arjuna, I can fight, but this fight, how can I do that? And he thought also, this huge armies. And if all the Kshatriyas are killed, what will happen? Because Kshatriya literally means one who protects from harm. So if all the Kshatriyas are killed, then what will happen to human society? Then the Durta, the rascals, they will have a free hand, and they will exploit the whole situation. Women will be unprotected, and as a result of illicit unions, Varna Sankara, unwanted children will be born. So Arjuna was in a dilemma that I should fight, because the opposite party, headed by Duryodhana, they don't have any rightful claim. And it's my duty to support my brother. And Krishna, he is supporting it also. So I should fight. But on the other hand, if I fight, then there'll be such a bad effect. So he was in a dilemma. What to do? What not to do? So this dilemma everyone has to face at some point in their life, or actually at some point in our life we are going to be faced, if at all we have a sense of dharma. Of course, in the modern world, people think, well, just do whatever you like, it doesn't matter. But that is foolish. Innately, we feel within ourselves that something is right and something is wrong. And even the people who say, do whatever you like, they would also agree that, for instance, this is a horrible example, but I'm just giving it to make the point clear. Even someone who says that there's no right and no wrong, and whatever you do, everything is okay, they would also say that to walk up to a three-year-old child and shoot him dead is also horrible and wrong. So innately we feel there is right and there is wrong, and as a consequence of this, we will be faced with so many situations in our life, what to do, what not to do. And actually at every moment that is there, in everything we do, we can choose to do that which is better or that which is worse. Now, Vedic Dharma, this teaches us at the level of Karma Kanda, this teaches us about Punya and Pap, of pious activities and sinful activities. Unfortunately, in the modern age, what is punya and what is pap, there's not much education about this. And therefore, even in India, among Hindus, many activities which were previously people were afraid to commit, thinking that it was sinful, they have now become considered normal, or they have been promoted as good. You're probably aware that in America there's an ongoing controversy about abortion. There isn't in India. In America, the Christian lobby, they say that abortion is sinful. And actually in in Veda Shastra, it's also very clear that to destroy the fetus within the womb is sinful. But Indian government propaganda has been that it is good to have abortion to control the population. And thus it is considered normal, and all over India, wherever we go, you see in the trains, in local train in Bombay, there'll be 10 minutes 100 rupees, and next to that 10 minutes 90 rupees abortion posters. And more grossly, in I spend a lot of time in Gujarat, you'll find written in Gujarati on the walls in the villages, not to speak of the towns, Garbhapat, they're so rupee. That's all. No other. And then a phone number. No, nothing else. So there's one example. Another prominent example is that, like I was saying, in modern India, it was thought that one who was born in supposed Kshatriya family, though they're not practicing as Kshatriyas most of them, it's considered that that in itself means it's all right to eat meat. Although traditional Kshatriyas, it wasn't that they went to the butcher's shop and bought meat, but they were allowed to eat meat. They would go and hunt in the forest and kill animals. There were different reasons for doing so. One was to lessen the population of dangerous animals. And another was that they have to be practiced in killing, because killing is not nice. And they would be practiced in doing so, because if they just practice with their weapons, and they don't actually kill any living being, that at the time of battle, when they actually have to fight human beings, then if they become squeamish, then they can't do it. So they have to become inured to killing. So Kshatriyas would kill animals in the forest, and those animals would be brought and offered in sacrifice, and then Kshatriyas, they would take meat. Not that it was a daily occurrence even for Kshatriyas, but nowadays in modern India, so yeah, previously the other castes, they wouldn't eat meat. They would think that, well, to eat meat is sinful, we can't do that. Or another way that meat could be eaten, that would mostly be by the Shudra castes, that they would engage a Brahmin of sorts to make an offering to Kali. They would cut some goat or buffalo. Buffaloes they offer to Bhairav, and more, and goats to Kali. But, and then they would take the meat. But that also under a restriction, only on the Amavasya, on the new moon night when it's very dark, once a month that offering could be made, not that daily. So it was restricted, it was allowed, but it was restricted. But the Brahmanas, the Vaishyas, they would be strictly vegetarian. And the other castes also, most of the time. But now it's advertised that you have to eat more meat to become more healthy. They're advertising that in India. Although in the West, they're advertising don't eat meat to become more healthy. They went through their mass meat eating phase. Because even in the West previously, people were mostly vegetarian. They weren't eating meat all the time. Not as a matter of principle, but because they didn't have factory farming, and they didn't have freezers to freeze the meat, so it was on occasion only. So this is just an example of how values have changed, and people previously thought in terms of opinion and part, that's still there, but to a lesser degree. Some of the things which were considered part previously people nowadays think it's just normal. But that doesn't change the law of karma. The law of karma is still there. So people who engage in sinful activities, they have to suffer for that. So I was talking about problems and dilemmas. We have to, problems arise, or dilemmas arise, when we're not sure what to do, what's the right thing to do. Arjuna was in that situation. Now, how can we understand what is the best thing to do? Well, traditionally, people would approach a guru. And the guru should be one who knows what is best for a human being, according to scripture. Guru means one who understands on a level more deep than we do. Because the average person just sees in terms of the immediate situation. But those who are Shastravit, they understand as Krishna understands. Arjuna approached Krishna with a problem that he couldn't work out the solution by his own intelligence. Arjuna, despite being a great fighter, had the humility to admit to Krishna that with my own intelligence I cannot understand what is the right thing to do. If whatever way, if I fight, it seems bad because I have to fight and kill my relatives and my gurus, and the women will be left unprotected. So, but if I don't fight, that also doesn't look good. Because if I don't fight, then Yudhishthira is depending upon me, and these people who are Duryodhana's party, who are misusing their position, and they will go unchecked. So he was in a dilemma. So he approached Krishna, who he had faith in Krishna. He had humility to approach Krishna with the faith that Krishna can teach me on a level of understanding that is deeper than the one I presently have. He can give me proper advice. So, Bhagavad Gita then is relevant in our lives today. It is not simply a book for Hindus. Krishna didn't say to Arjuna, let's have an interfaith session. We'll say a few Christian prayers and a few Muslim prayers and a few Hindu prayers and hope for the best. Hope that someone out there is helping us. But Krishna, even though he is Bhagavan himself and he is fully competent to make the arrangements according to Arjuna's desire, but Krishna helped Arjuna. Of course, he helped him by driving his chariot. But Krishna helped Arjuna in the best possible way by giving him transcendental knowledge by which he could understand on a deeper level what are the nature of his problems. So what are our problems? Some health problem, we go to the doctor. Or we do some yoga. Financial problem, get a loan. That makes another problem, get another loan. Or stress problem, well, you can take some pills. What's that called for stress? Prozac? Is it Prozac? Yeah. I've heard that word a lot in my visit in America. It seems like half the population's on Prozac.
One third.
Yeah. Is it? Yeah, one third. When I was a kid, there was some other thing, Valium. The housewives used to take Valium, and everyone else.
To give it to kids.
What, Valium?
Yeah.
It doesn't work for housewives anymore. They need something stronger, is it? So there are solutions, but these are only stopgap solutions. Taking a pill doesn't really solve the problem. And even doing meditation to reduce stress, that doesn't really solve the problem. Krishna pointed out to Arjuna that whatever the problems are that he may see, he hasn't seen that the real problem is not the immediate problem facing us. But the real problems that we face are janma mrityu jaravyadhi dukkha dosha anudarshana. The real problems that we face is that by nature this material world is full of misery. And however much we counteract all our problems, the very nature of this world is that we'll get more problems and more problems and more problems. And minimally, everybody has to face the problem of dying, old age, disease, and rebirth. And as long as we're in this material world, these problems are there. And many people, when presented with this proposition, actually it's not a proposition, it's a fact, when confronted with the fact that we all have to face the problems of birth, death, old age and disease, many people just try to pass it off, or I say, well, that's natural, you know, you can't avoid that. But Krishna tells us we can avoid it and we should avoid it. Well, if we can get free from birth, death, old age and disease, then why would anybody not want to do so? If we have the opportunity to get free from these terrible problems, then why should we not be very eager to do so? Actually, all the problems, whatever problem it may be, health problem, or we don't like the person in the sitting next to us in our office problem, or a financial problem, or family problem, so many unlimited varieties of problems, we can never tell which one is going to come next. We may not even imagine. Many of the most serious problems we don't even imagine. We're just sitting in our office doing some work, and all of a sudden we have some terrible pain, and then we're rushed off to the hospital. We didn't even know it, but we need a bypass surgery or something like this. So all these problems take place within the framework of repeated birth and death. So why shouldn't we become eager to get free from birth and death? If birth and death, we're in this scenario where we have to die, we have to get born again. We may be born as a human being, or as a dog, or a cat, or a chicken, or a tree, or a deva in heaven. Whatever form we get born in, we have to die again. And we have to suffer in between so many problems. Then why should we not be eager to get free from this problematic situation? The reason is, as Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, that we are attached to the tiny bit of happiness that we can achieve in material life. Material life is simply one problem after another. But if we get free from some problem, we think this is happiness. Just like on a hot day, if we walk into an air-conditioned room, we think, now I feel very nice. Or if we're stressed out and we take some medication for a reason, now I feel relaxed. Although the medication itself produces more problems. And the air condition also produces problems, because by going from the heat to the cold, then you get a cold, and that's also miserable. And then you take some more medication which helps that to go away. Then the cold goes away and you think, oh, now I feel much better. I was just in Seattle, I also got a cold. So then you feel, then it goes away and you think, oh, now I feel much better. then another kind of sickness comes. So material life means that there are so many problems, and we get some relief from that and we feel that's very nice. Or really increases the adrenaline flow, and that feels, whoa, this is really wonderful. That which is very much central to the modern materialistic American way of life is great stress on sex. So that means that it's a burst of sensation, or taking mind-altering drugs, such as crack is very popular. So I don't know what it's like to take crack, and I'm sure all of you don't either, but we hear that it gives some boost or some rush or some sensation like that, or driving very fast or surfing. These are all activities which make us feel, have some sensation. It's adrenaline, it promotes the adrenaline, or watching sports, and then you become attached. Our team will win. And then when someone on the our team or the India team hits a six, then great. So, or if the umpire gives a wrong call and our favorite batsman is out unfairly, and this way we become, the adrenaline runs and we feel, yes, this is, we get pleasure from being attached to sports or driving fast or surfing. But what is this rush of adrenaline? It feels pleasurable, but what it's doing, it's just covering the sense of emptiness or the problematic life we have, or the directionless, dishahin life that we have. And without understanding our actual purpose of life, we voluntarily accept problems just so that we can feel that now we have something, some direction, to make ourselves feel useful and worthwhile. People get married, and everyone knows when you get married, there are many problems. Because you have to bring money and then look after children. There are many problems in family life. But we gladly accept them because it gives us some sense of worth. And our children, look after them, and the children come up to us and we feel, yes, they're dependent on me. So we accept problems for the sake of overcoming them, feeling that I am overcoming them. But ultimately, we are powerless. Just like when Hurricane Katrina came, no one can stop. Bring the whole American military machine, bring all the scientists in the world, none of them can do anything whatsoever to even slightly obstruct the progress of that hurricane. Many scientists are researching how to stop cancer, how to stop AIDS. There are not many scientists investigating malaria, although that also kills many people. But I guess it's mostly in the third world, and they don't have much, there won't be much income from finding drugs to stop malaria, so they're not much bothered about that. That's interesting, isn't it? Are they doing it for the benefit of mankind or for the benefit of their bank balance? Seems like they're doing it for their bank balance. Otherwise, they should be just as busy to stop malaria as they are to stop AIDS and cancer, isn't it? So there's multiple sclerosis or something, and so many diseases they're trying to stop. Why is there no research how to stop death. Stop the whole thing. Stop death altogether. They know we cannot stop death. We can maybe stop cancer, then you'll die later from something else. You stop AIDS and you'll die later from... But everyone has to die. Now that's a big problem. We should be eager to get free from death, but we're not, because we identify ourselves with the situation that we're in. And we think that my pleasure in life is overcoming one problem after another. And we take that to be pleasure. And we never really, although we take out life insurance, we never really take it seriously that I have to die. Maybe you are aware of the Yaksha Prashna section of Mahabharata, in which a yaksha, or a, what would you call, a kind of supernatural being, questioned Yudhishthira Maharaj. He asked him so many questions. So one of the questions he asked Yudhishthira Maharaj is, what is the most amazing thing? This word, Ascharya, what is the most amazing thing? Now Yudhishthira Maharaj had, he was previously emperor of the whole world. He had information from all over the world. And he, not only from this planet, but from all different planets of the universe. He had information, the rishis had told him, and Arjuna had personally gone and given information from the heavenly planets. So he was highly educated about all the goings-on, not only in this planet, but even on other planets. But what did he say was the most amazing thing? That ahani ahani bhutani gacchantiha yamalayam shesha sthavara icchanti kimascharya matakparam. He said that every day so many people make a journey from here to Yamalaya. Yamalaya means Yamalok, or the place of death. That's called the final journey. It is not the final journey. There's, life goes on after death. So Yudhishthira Maharaj said that those who are not going just now, those who are not dying right now, they think, I shall stay here. They're making plans to enjoy life here, even though they see my father has gone, my grandfather has gone, my uncle has gone, my brother has gone, my cat has gone, my dog has gone, and they never think that it's going to be me also. Instead of making plans how to get free from repeated death, they're making plans how to enjoy this life. Kimascharya atapra. What is more amazing than this? Yudhishthira Maharaj said. It's just like if someone gave you news that some terrorists are going to blow up your house tomorrow. Then what would you do? You'd call the police to try to protect, or you would get out of the house. Or if they told the terrorists they're going to blow up your house in 10 minutes, you say, well, I'm busy decorating it. And there's a football game on TV starting, so you turn it on. So I say, well, your house is going to be blown up. There's a TV game. I want to watch the TV. It's an important game. And I'm just in the middle of decorating and trying to making it better. You see, but it's going to be blown up. But I've been planning this decoration for 2 years, and I've saved up, and I'm doing it personally, I designed it myself, but it's going to be blown up. Just shut up. So, is that intelligent? We have to decorate the house, repair it, and watch the football game on TV. But you're going to get blown up. Anyway, it doesn't. Anyway, that's natural. It's normal. So it's like that. We're putting on lipstick and making plans how this body shall be very healthy, doing yoga so that we can live a long life, eating natural food so we can live a long life, but we don't consider that the body's going to die. What happens after that? And then we get the reply, well, you know, anyway, nothing happens after that. Or we get, nothing happens after that, so don't worry about it. Or we get simplistic replies, that you just believe in Jesus, and then Jesus will look after you. You, throughout your life, you can eat meat and drink beer and cheat others in your business, but you just give some money to the church, and you say, I believe in Jesus, and become born again, and you will go to heaven. And if you don't believe in Jesus, you go to hell. This is childish religion, actually. That you just by saying, I believe, and then you go to heaven. And you don't, and you go to hell. It's much more complex than that. So we either ignore the question altogether, or we take some simplistic reply, that I believe in Jesus. Finished. No more need to think about anything. Or we put it off, we think that, well, now I'm busy working, and later on, when I'm 99 and a half years old, then I'll think about religion. So in various ways, we try to avoid the actual issue, which is that we have attained this human form of life. Now we have the opportunity for Brahma Jignyasa. Human life is meant for inquiry into the absolute truth. What is the purpose of life? Why are we suffering in this world? How can we get free from repeated birth and death? You may say, well, I don't believe that after you die you get born again, law of karma. You can say we don't believe, but that is ostrich philosophy. The ostrich puts his head in the sand, and when a predator comes, the ostrich puts his head in the sand. He says, I don't believe that anyone's going to come. How could anyone be so nasty? I'm such a nice ostrich, and I'm a good ostrich, and I'm a well-wishing ostrich to all others. So why would anyone come and shoot me? And as he's philosophizing in this way, with his head in the sand, he gets shot. And that's the end of his ostrichness. He becomes a non-ostrich and goes on to another situation. So this ostrich philosophy of, well, we just don't want to think about it. We'll go to the temple and we'll say our prayers and we'll put some money in the box and we'll be good and that's it. Krishna doesn't ask us in Bhagavad Gita just to be good and go to the temple and put some money in the box. That's alright, you can do that. That is good. That's better than not doing it, and you should do that. But the temple is actually not meant, it's not mainly meant for darshan just by seeing. But it's meant for darshan by hearing. Darshan means seeing, and darshan also means tattva-gyan. So temple is meant more for tattva-gyan than for seeing. That's why there's a system in the temple. Before you leave, you should sit down, right? You should sit down. So often we see people, they go, they pray for 2 minutes, put some money in the box, come back a bit, sit down, stand up and walk out. It's part of the ritual. You just sit down for 5 seconds is enough. You get up and go. But sit down means you should sit down and hear. And the priest in the temple doesn't mean that he's just saying some mantras, making some offerings and taking donations. But Brahmana means pandit, and he's supposed to teach those who are coming what is the purpose of life. What is our real duty in life? Who is Bhagavan? What is our relationship with him? But nowadays the pandits, they're not pandits, they don't know. They can only say some mantras, and mostly they don't know the meaning of that either. The meaning of the mantra is, put $10 here. For them, that's the meaning of the mantra. Once I asked one I was hearing some mantras chanted by visiting some temple in South India, and I was listening to the mantra. I couldn't quite catch what it meant. It sounded very nice, something. So I asked the priest, "What does that mean?" He said, "I don't know. My father taught me. When you ring the bell, you say this. I don't know what it means." He didn't think it. Every day he was saying the mantra, but he never thought it was important to know what it means. For him, it's his job. Someone is a barber, you go to the barber, they cut your hair. Someone is a tailor, they take your measurement, they make a shirt. Someone is a priest, they ring the bell, ding, 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 and that's all. But actually, Brahmana means Brahma Janatiti Brahmana, one who knows the absolute truth and teaches it to others. But nowadays it's become a ritual. But actually, we should know this Bhagavad Gita, what Krishna is teaching. This is the most important information. The most important thing you can do in your life is what? Come to California? Well, many people would think like that. That we'll come to California and then there'll be enough money. And there's never enough money. That's the illusion. And it'll be prestigious, and California, everyone should be happy because the climate's good, people have money, they have nice houses, and there's the beach, and everyone should be happy. But when we arrive, we find in California, no one's happy. Why is that? They have everything that should make them happy, but no one's happy. Why is that? Because they didn't read Bhagavad Gita. And if they read Bhagavad Gita, then they can understand dukhalayam. This material world is by nature full of misery. So that even if we have all the things that we think should make us happy, they won't make us happy. And what to speak of California, we may think, oh, I got it wrong, I should have gone to Hawaii. Then you go to Hawaii, and people are also not happy. And even if you go to Swarg, they're also not happy there. So what's the problem? The problem is that by nature, this material world is full of misery. But there is a place where we can actually be happy. That is beyond this material world. That is Vaikuntha, Golok, the land of Krishna. We are meant to be happy because as spiritual beings, we are spiritual beings. Our nature is Satchit Ananda. By nature we are eternal, full of knowledge and bliss. But this material world by its nature is Asat, Achit and Nirananda. Satchit Ananda means eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss. But everything in this material world is temporary. There are trees in California, thousands of years old. They will also come down at some point in time. America is now the most powerful country in the world, but it won't last. Rome, Egypt, Greece, even Iraq, at one point in time was the center of the most powerful civilization. Now it's just a literally bombed out country. So it won't last. America, Britain, the sun never sets on the British Empire, they say. It's set. So the American Empire won't remain. Nothing will remain. So Asat, everything is temporary. We are full of ignorance, even though we may be computer engineers or PhDs, but we are ignorant of the most important information of who we are, what is the purpose of life, what happens after death. And Ananda, we are near Ananda. We may have a little pleasure from various things. Looking after our children gives us pleasure. Or eating various kinds of foods gives us pleasure. But the soul hankers for unlimited pleasure. Therefore, because we are Atma, we can never be happy. The Atma, we can never be happy in the material situation, because as Atma, our constitutional position or dharma is Satchit Anandama. And this material world, the situation is Asat, Achit, Nirananda. We identify with this situation, therefore we can never be happy. So in Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna explains in detail all these points and tells us the simple formula by which we can attain the happiness, true happiness, for which we all hanker. That is Atmasukh. Dehasukh, or bodily happiness, that can never satisfy us. Atmasukh, the happiness of the soul, that is actual happiness. That Krishna told to Arjuna, that your real problem is not whether to fight or not to fight, but the real problem is misidentification of ourselves with the present situation in which we find ourselves. We consider, I am this body, I am Indian or American, I am male or female, I am a computer engineer or a interior designer or a barber or a butcher or whatever. We identify with this. This is my wife, this is my husband, these are our children. But we should know that all these situations are temporary, and that our real situation is at the lotus feet of Bhagavan Krishna as his eternal servant. So what should we do? Give up our jobs, fly back to India, find a cave, give up everything, meditate? No. We don't recommend that. If any of you were to suggest to me that now I'm going to give up my job, my family, and go and meditate in a cave, I would tell you, no, don't do that. Remain here with your family. But make a change in your life. The change should be to live our lives according to the principles of Bhagavad Gita, by chanting Hare Krishna and practicing Bhakti Yoga at home. Arjuna wanted to give up the fight. Krishna told him, no. Mam anusmara yudhyacha. Think of me and fight. Not just fight, but think of me and fight. So thinking of Krishna is the main thing. But that doesn't mean that we should totally change our present material situation, because we are now in this situation, and instead of trying to change it, which is in itself troublesome and unnecessary, we should rather try to understand why we are in this situation and how we can come to our actual situation, which is the spiritual situation of being situated in Krishna consciousness. And although family life can generally be understood to be Maya, or the cause of illusory identification with the body, but family life in Krishna consciousness, understanding that I'm in this situation, I have responsibility to my family members, that responsibility is for roti, kapra, makan, shiksha, all these different things. But over and above that, above food, clothing, shelter, and arranging for education, it is the duty of every parent to teach their children how they can live in this world in such a way that they will never have to take birth again. That is possible by Krishna bhakti. So, how we can live in this world according to Bhagavad Gita. That is the best way to live. That is the best advice we can give to everyone. That we live our lives according to the principles of Bhagavad Gita. It's not something outdated. Because even though 5,000 years ago they may not have had superhighways and Prozac and Boeing 747s and computers and cell phones and all these things that we have today, the basic human situation is the same. Everyone is trying to be happy without knowing how to be happy, and therefore everyone is simply living in this their lives and dying without knowing where we are going to, what is the result of our activities. So Bhagavad Gita gives us that knowledge. That knowledge was given to Arjuna 5,000 years ago, and even to Vivasva, the sun god, even millions of years ago. Bhagavad Gita is immortal knowledge. It is relevant to every human being in every time and every circumstance throughout history, past, present and future. It is not meant for specifically for Hindus, although mostly Hindus, tend to have faith in Bhagavad Gita, but it's not. This knowledge applies to everyone. That you have been born in a Hindu family, or we can say that birth in Hindu family, that maybe makes people more open to understand this. But it's actually immortal knowledge for every person, whether they're born as Hindu, Muslim, Christian, or whatever. God is not a Hindu, a Muslim, or a Christian. He is as He is. It is our duty to understand Him. Bhagavad Gita gives detailed knowledge of how to understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead and ourselves, and how we can live in this world in a manner that we can live very happily, actually. Because we know that we are under Krishna's protection. And we don't engage in activities that are certain to result in more problems and more anxiety. A devotee lives a very simple life in many ways. A devotee is not concerned with acquiring more and more and more and more objects. As in the modern world, they're saying, buy this, buy this, buy this, take credit, and simply increasing our anxiety, filling up our houses with things which don't really help us at all. But a devotee knows that our life should be centered on Krishna, and Krishna can be satisfied by simple offerings of leaves and flowers. Especially Krishna likes flowers very much, so if we offer these with love, Krishna will be satisfied. So the real thing we have to increase in our life is not our income or our possessions, but our love for Krishna. And that is the secret of happy living. And that is how we can live in this world very happily, taking advice from Bhagavad Gita as it is. So we advise and request everyone, please try to understand this Bhagavad Gita as it is. Apply it in your life. And just see how much life is improved by doing so. This is our humble request to you all. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Is there any question about this, please?
Is there really life after death?
Well, let's put it like this.
Can you get
by empiric means, we can't prove so either way. By empiric means, there is no means to positively state that there is life after death. And there's no means to positively state that there isn't life after death. But all the great persons in history, in all cultures of the world, who have by their behavior, by their realization, impressed generations after people at that time and generations after them with their spiritual realization have all stated that yes, there is life after death. Persons who are on a universally recognized as being on a higher level of spiritual understanding, they all say that there is life after death, that the soul is eternal. Whether you say soul or atma or ruh or whatever word, that yes, there is life after death.
Why there are bad souls and good souls?
Wait a minute, I didn't finish. I have more to say on this subject, first of all. In recent years, there have been empiric attempts to show that there is life after death also. And there are professors who have made as empirically watertight as can be possible when we're dealing with such phenomena, inquiries into persons who remember their previous lives. And there are many such cases of children who they go on talking about some situation in some other place which they could not have knowledge of. And then after some time their parents bring them to that place, just like they find some village 200 miles away, and then they remember, oh, this is my brother, this is my cousin, this is my husband, and they remember, and all little details that only someone who is a family member could remember, and they identify themselves with a person who has died, and they say yes, and this was the pet name that my husband used to call me. So all these and even they'll find something like, but they become confused that there should be a door here, but why is there? There's not a door in that house. They say, yeah, we filled in that door 2 years ago. There was a door there which no one can see. So there are many things. You can go on the internet and find. There's one professor, Ian Stevenson. He's done many, or by hypnosis, they take someone into a past life, and then they speak, someone who's lived in America all their life, and they speak in some dialect like Provençal of the Provence region of France, of that dialect as it was spoken 200 years ago, and there are recordings of this, and they don't know French, what to speak of 200 years old dialect of French. So in this way there is very good evidence, even empirically, to suggest that yes, there is life after death. Why there are bad souls and good souls? There are no bad souls, there are only good souls. But in this material world, everyone comes here with the aim and intent of forgetting Krishna. So we're all in this material world, we're all bad to some extent. How we behave depends on various factors, such as according to the consciousness that we have acquired in a previous life or cultivated in a previous life, then we continue to cultivate the same kind of consciousness in this life. But a lot depends on association also. You can see how people's behavior change. Just like when people come from India to America, people's behavior and their outlook on life changes. And that's especially true with children. When they come and then they're brought up one way at home, but then the atmosphere outside is so different that they don't want to be like the way their parents want them to be. And they may, because their friends are doing so, they may engage in frightening activities because the power of association is so strong. Therefore, satsang is always recommended. Always keep good association. That will help us to be strong. To be strong in following the right path. Because asatsanga or asat, prerana, is very strong in the modern age. The advertisements, buy this, buy that, or on the TV, what you see, it's all asat prerana, instigating us to do that which is asat or sinful or against our self-interest. So you also have somewhat of an existential problem coming from one culture to another. The most intelligent person coming from one culture to another would find out the best things in both cultures and adhere to the best, instead of fully going one way or fully going the other, should find the best thing in each culture and adhere to those things in Western culture which are good, and adhere to those things in Indian culture which are good. So in Indian culture there is spiritual knowledge which in the West it doesn't come anywhere near it actually. The spiritual knowledge and the way of life, and so that's something, that's not something to be ashamed of, that, oh, now I have to start eating lots of meat and drinking lots of wine and be ashamed of being, why not be proud of that this culture has something to offer, it's something worth following. I don't have to be like a sheep following the worst in the West. Of course, in America also, so many people are vegetarians and teetotalers, but somehow or other, many Indians who come to the West, they think that now I have to eat lots of meat and drink lots of wine to be American. But why? And why do we have to be American anyway? What's so great about that? But of course, there are some good things in American culture, like punctuality is definitely better than in India. I came late to the program. They said, I was told, that, well, it's all Indians coming, so if we come late, if we go on time, there's no point, because everyone will come late. But punctuality is also good. Here we have PST, Pacific Standard Time, not IST, the famous Indian stretchable time. So that's good. Or the work culture is that you're given a job to do, you should do it well. That's good. You should try and do your job properly. You're getting paid and you should work and do what you're paid for. So that's good. That's a good thing. But the driving force in our life, we should see what's the main purpose of our life. That's neither Indian nor American. Krishna wasn't and isn't an Indian. And in those days there was no concept of India as such. That was actually, that came up. Actually the British, they, of course, in the days of Yudhishthira, there was the whole world, we have information from Shastra, was under Yudhishthira Maharaj. But later on, the land, what would we call India? I don't know, it's difficult to say. It's British India wasn't the, what you could say, the historical, what to call it, Hindustan, that's also a later term. But from the stans, that goes as far as Tatarstan. That's in Russia, modern day Russia, there's Tatarstan. And in Central Asia, there are so many. Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, so Afghanistan. And so this suggests that this was all under Vedic culture, that's all part of ancient India. And in Mahabharata we see that all the kings of the world assemble. The king of Kamboj is one of the famous fighters in the Mahabharata war. Kamboj means Kampuchea. So, and Burma, the British call Burma, that's Brahmadesh. And Thailand, Siam, Shamadesh. So what is India, actually? Krishna wasn't in India. But anyway, for the sake of, in a conventional sense, we can say that this Indian culture is that which helps us to understand the real purpose of life. And that the tattva gyan of Indian culture, the vast knowledge, is summarized in Bhagavad Gita. So we should, if we live our lives according to Bhagavad Gita, that will be very helpful for us. We won't have all this stress problem, because we'll understand that stress means we're taking things too seriously. Like that. And there's this problem, that problem. We know everything here is temporary. What we should take seriously is our spiritual life. And spiritual life means that ananyas chintayanto mam yejana paryapasate tesham nityabhiyatana yoga kshemam vahamyaham. Krishna says that those who are always thinking of me, I look after them. So Krishna's looking after us. So no need to be in great anxiety. No need of prosa. Just chant Hare Krishna. It works. I never took a Prozac in my life. That's unusual for me. Or any such pill. That's highly unusual for someone born in England in the 1950s. Mostly everyone is taking some medication at some point in time. Someone takes sleeping pills. I was given an injection once for sleeping because I hadn't slept for 2 nights due to tooth pain. Doctor said, I'm giving you an injection just so you can sleep. Not good to go without sleeping. But I didn't, out of stress or lack of sleep. So, you chant Hare Krishna and be happy. Any other questions?
What's in our hand and what's in the hand of God?
Very good question. Very good question. What is in our hand? To a large extent, we are controlled. We don't choose when we are born. We don't choose when we are die. When we are to die. We don't choose how we get sick, when we get sick, to what extent we get sick. There are many things we are not in control of. But we do have the freedom to choose to act properly or not. Circumstances, to a large extent, are dictated to us, but we can choose, just like Arjuna had to choose whether to fight or not. So we can choose, there are certain life decisions we can make, such as whether to chant Hare Krishna or not, whether to eat meat or to eat Krishna prasadam. These are certain decisions we can make. Now, even that choice is to a large extent influenced by the consciousness we have acquired from a previous life and from the association that we're in. Therefore, it's recommended take good association, satsanga. So what is in our hands, the best thing we can do is to choose to keep company with saintly people who will not mislead us, who will advise us to act in the best manner possible so that we can live our life in a godly manner, and in this way we'll benefit ourselves and our family members and everyone we come in contact with. Now you may say, well, how can I live a godly life being in the workforce because it's tough? Well, we may have to be tough, just like Arjuna, he had to be tough on the battlefield, but nevertheless Arjuna fought according to principles. He wasn't just going and lopping people's heads off needlessly. He fought according to, he considered very carefully after taking advice from Krishna. On Krishna's advice, he fought, he took advice from Krishna throughout. So like this, the general spiritual direction of our life, we should choose to take that. And under guidance, from Guru and from Shastra, Bhagavad Gita, we should see how to act in a way that is conducive for our own spiritual well-being and for the spiritual well-being of those in direct contact with us. Now, when we say spiritual well-being, that doesn't mean to the negation of our material well-being. It's not that we're going, like I say, we're not going to tell you to go and live in a cave and give up your home and all that. As long as we're in this situation, we should maintain it at a normal level. No need to try to become another Bill Gates or anything like that. But at a level that was within our grasp, we should maintain it. Not that we're working 16 hours a day and we have no time for anything else. Everything should be balanced. Yukta hara viharasya yukta chistasya karmasu yukta svapnavabodhasya yoga bhavati dukaha. Lord Krishna teaches us in Bhagavad Gita that how to practice yoga, and that doesn't necessarily mean exercise, but yoga means, bhakti yoga means how to live our life in connection with Krishna. So one who is balanced in eating, sleeping and chaste endeavors, such a person can conquer over all miseries. So it's very practical.